Welcome to Asian Pacific Voices Radio, where you'll find stimulating conversations that explore diverse topics and stories impacting our Asian Pacific American communities. I'm your host, Rasha Goel, and today I am so excited to be featuring an extraordinary artist whose work transcends boundaries and seamlessly blends the rich tapestry of Japanese tradition with the vibrant energy of Western urban culture. From his early days as a graffiti artist and being in tagging crews such as KGB and KIIS, to his current status as a major star in LA's downtown art scene, his evolution as an artist is fascinating and an exploration of identity, culture, and the convergence of diverse influences. It's my pleasure to welcome Gajin Fujita on Asian Pacific Voices Radio. Hi, Gajin. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Rasha. And it's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Thanks. Such a pleasure to be here as we've watched your work evolve, especially in the city of Los Angeles, and just the way it's been celebrated. So let's go back. You are an Angeleno. You were born and raised in Boyle Heights to Japanese parents who also were from the art world as well. A fine art painter. Your father was a fine art painter. Mother is an art conservator. And they evidently played significant roles in shaping your artistic journey. So if you could share a little bit about how their influence, particularly your father's, led to your graffiti endeavors at such a young age, but really impacted your early perception of art and the unique blend of bringing together traditional and contemporary elements in your work.
So my dad was a big influence just due to the fact that he and my mom had immigrated from Japan to LA because he wanted to go to art school, and he went to Otis, where he couldn't finish his degree because he had me and my brothers. And that was late 1970 when he came out to LA with my mom. And all the street graffiti stuff wasn't like a direct influence from my dad, but what I had seen, because my father had used his our house as his studio, and he used one of the bedrooms as his studio, and I would, as a child, hear him painting like into the wee hours of the night, and I would hear back then in the early 80s, late 70s, people were still playing records, LPs, and he would have he had a huge collection of Pink Floyd albums, and I can always hear him playing like Shine On You Crazy Diamond, that album in particular. And it was intriguing for a little child that I was. And it was kind of perplexing, and I always wanted to see what he was doing behind the closed door, because it was lit at night. And during the morning, I would go peep in there, and he'd have all kinds of oil paint tubes laying on the floor. And it just looked like candy to me. And I think that was like my first influence to and sort of a teaching moment to liking color so much. He had a way with color and oil paint, so yeah, that was like the early influence, I think. And also my mom, she later on, when I was in my 20s, late teens, she started refurbishing and conserving old Japanese antiques. And that was a huge influence as well, because I was going to Otis at the time, and I would see all these old antique sort of artifacts or lots of ceramics that she had fixed doing kintsugi, which is like fixing ceramics with gold and mending them together. And then she had this one, she was fixing this one old Japanese samurai armor, which I thought was very interesting, and it was so old, and she used an Rushi technique. I don't know what that would translate to in English, but my childhood in the house was richly filled with a lot of art, and
yes,
that played an important role, I think. It guided me indirectly. I mean, my parents, my dad, just because he was a struggling artist, I think he did not want any of his children to become artists or follow the path of being a creative. But I guess it was ingrained in my DNA.
Yeah, it looks like it was in the genes, right? I mean, because you continued, you went to school at Otis as well. It almost is like carrying on a dream, right?
Carrying on a dream, yes. And I was able to graduate and obtain my degree. Unfortunately, my father had passed away the year before I had graduated. And I graduated Otis in 97. I went on to graduate school as well, which helped me keep painting, and there were several professors that that helped me do that and achieve my degrees and goals of painting.
Well, and your career has this beautiful span, Gajin. So let's go to the beginning of where you first started off with graffiti art, and you were with tagging crews like KGB. How did graffiti serve as a form of self-expression for you during that time?
It's funny because graffiti came into my life really. I mean, I was aware of it growing up in Boyle Heights. There was a lot of street gang graffiti surrounding everywhere I went in my neighborhood. But the hip hop graffiti came into my life as I started junior high school, middle school, where I got bused out to from East LA out to Mid City. So that was like 1984, and it was right when hip hop was transitioning out to the West from the East Coast, so to speak. So a lot of kids were into breakdancing, being b-boys, rapping, emceeing, and then there was the graffiti aspect. And when I went to middle school, it was a middle school called LACES, Laces. It was right on Pico and Arlington at the time. And so it was an eye-opening experience for me because I was growing up in Boyle Heights and that's all I knew. It was mostly predominantly Latino. And when I started school at LACES, it was very diverse. I saw the spectrum of the classes in our city here in LA. So you had kids that were getting bused in from the Palisades. You had kids bused in from South Central, Hollywood, and East LA. And so when I began middle school there, I got to see all this diversity, and a lot of kids were really into hip hop, and it was the first time ever for me to see kids dressed in like hip hop attire. Kids were coming to school with Kangos on, wearing Kazelle shades, had the suede Pumas and Adidas's, and with the fat laces. it almost seemed like I was walking into a movie of some kind. And that was like my introduction to hip hop. And graffiti was calling because I felt like you could be known as an alias, because we all create sort of this pen name, an alias, for our tags. And I like that aspect of being stealth, but it was esoteric at the same time. Only kids that were doing graffiti would know what your tag was or who you were. And so there was a little element of getting away with like tagging on in, you know, at school or something, where the teachers and the principal had a hard time catching you. And I think that was the element that drew me really into graffiti, is that sort of mischievous element that came with it. And back then also, graffiti was still looked at, it wasn't accepted socially, and it was still like kind of shunned upon and looked at as like a crime. But also the other attraction on the other side was that I felt like we could beautify the city at the same time with these elaborate sort of text and forms of color. And it was very artistic. And that was really the inspiration.
Well, and then, so, and you use that style in your artwork for a little bit, but then you pivoted over to fine art. So was there a yes. particular moment, or was this just an evolution that happened along the way as an artist? Talk to me about that transition there.
So I think a pivotal moment was really when I got out of high school and I was really doing nothing. I was partying with my friends, and doing graffiti. I graduated Fairfax High School in 1990. And also Fairfax had a visual arts magnet program. That's how I was able to get to from Boyle Heights to Fairfax, West Hollywood. Anyways, after graduating high school, I was lacking direction. And I started junior college. I went to East LA College, and with a friend of mine that was another colleague in the graffiti world. And we kind of looked at each other, and I looked back into what I've done, and most of it was like artistic and things I did out in the streets with the graffiti. And at East LA College, ended up taking art history classes and kind of delved into more of the creative and arts. So took a few painting classes, drawing classes, and I think that was the inspiration to take it to a higher education, take it to the next level, and really learn about art. And about 93 is when I started Otis. I applied for Otis, realizing that we had amazing art schools in Southern California. There was Pasadena Art Center, Cal Arts, Long Beach State, UCLA, and Otis, and just to name a few. And I chose Otis just because not only because of my father, but it was the school that was in downtown at the time. And I really liked the idea. And Otis was, I think, still known for fine arts, as opposed to like design or car auto design that Pasadena has. Cal Arts is very liberal. I applied to Otis and I got in also. Another factor is that my SAT scores were really crappy. And I,
because you were just meant to be an artist. We can totally say that and be okay with it. Like, that was the path, that was the journey. Yeah, it was in the blood.
but I think you know, the art schools were the only schools that accepted students without looking at their SAT scores. That's so okay. That was another huge factor, I think.
But it's fascinating to me.
Yeah. No, I think I remember my father was so pissed, like, that my SAT scores were so crappy. But anyway,
I remember being stressed out about that as well, because I was supposed to go to med school. I have art questions for you, but could you briefly, in like a minute to two, tell me what's going on with the artwork behind you? I see so many different colors and different things happening in the piece behind you.
Okay, so this is a painting called Demon Slayer, which I painted in 2014 through 2015. And it's an image of a mythical character named Shoki. I forget the translation. It's a Chinese myth in origin, and the Japanese have borrowed it, as well as they borrowed many cultural things from China. His the character's name is Zhong Kui in Chinese, and Zhong Kui appeared in an emperor who was bedridden and ill. I forget what century. It must have been like the 16th century or something like that. So it was a real life emperor who dreamt of this mythical character in his dream. And after he had awoken from the dream, he started to feel better, and he started to recover from his illness. I don't know what kind of illness he had, but he fully recovered, and he was so taken by his dream and this character that he dreamt of, he had like a court painter come and paint described, I guess. Or yeah, it's literally a mythical character from an emperor's dream. And so Zhong Kui is said to be riding a tiger, and in this interpretation I referenced a famous sort of a woodblock print artist from the 19th century, Edo period of Japan, Kawanabe Kyosai. And he painted what I referenced. And I just did it with spray paint and graffiti in the background. And yeah, that's what you see. I also added some twists where Zhong Kui is wearing like a Kango hat. So I gave it some contemporary twist. And the Slayer, or I had referenced the band Slayer, because Slayer, I think, comes from, it's a speed metal, sort of a death metal band that I listened to in the early 80s. And they come from LA as well. They come from the Huntington Park area.
I love how you're able to infuse all these elements together. And they seem to blend so well. And of course, you just mentioned woodblock. So there is this interest of the Japanese woodblock prints and the samurai culture that we do evidently see in your work. How do you incorporate these traditional elements in your pieces? And then what significance do they hold for you?
There's so much color and liveliness with the woodblock prints. That's how I was attracted to them first. And also through my mom, where she used to bring like old wood block prints home from, because she used to work at a Japanese antique shop, and she would bring home these woodblock prints, and I would just be fascinated and intrigued by them, and then started to read into them more, as they were sort of the journals of like the Edo period. Not only was I fascinated by the visual sort of language that I was reading, but also when I started to look into them further, some of them had, or a lot of them had, stories behind them, and it portrayed a spectrum of not only the sort of lives that were taking place at the time, but also historical stories, and I was really attracted to the historical stories of how the samurais lived, or like some of the more intriguing samurai stories of generals and wars that had taken place, and these figures that were larger than life, that were depicted like 200-300 years later, and these were the interpretations of these woodblock print artists, and so it still intrigues me to this day, where I wonder what these people really look like, because in the woodblock prints they're obviously exaggerated. And you know, there were no photographs back then, so they must have been amazing figures. And
it's so interesting though that their legacy is carried on like this, right?
Yeah,
through a woodblock that you're able to share.
Indeed. And that is also another sort of fascination that I have. The legacies of these larger than life figures that lived 400-500 years ago. And that's
so captivating.
That's what I'm interested in.
And how about the gold leaf? How does the gold leaf play a part into your work?
Well, gold leaf has been used over a great deal of time, I feel. And many cultures have used gold leaf. And this goes back like almost to the beginning of mankind, I believe, you know, at least 2000 years and more, I think. But my inspiration to use gold leaf came about when I was sitting in my studio while I was attending UNLV for my graduate degree. My mentor and my art coach, Dave Hickey from Vegas, in one of his lectures, he had told his students, us students, I guess, that art should violate people's expectations. And that really got me thinking. I had this graffiti component, or element, I should say, with the Japanese sort of woodblock print imagery, but I felt I was missing sort of one thing to really like take it over the top and be super violating. And so I was thinking about that phrase that Dave had mentioned in my studio, and I was flipping through an old photo album that I came across in my studio, and it was a photo album from 1987 of a family trip that my family took to Japan. And while I was flipping through it, a photo that I took of the Golden Pavilion, it's called the Kinkakuji in Kyoto, had captured my attention. And I looked at that and I was like, dang. So it was a moment of epiphany, and I thought, well, it would be super violating had someone gone to the Golden Pavilion and tagged the Golden Pavilion. So I wasn't going to do that because I would have probably been banned from ever going to Japan. So I just thought, well, I'll make my own gold leaf walls. And this way I would be able to do whatever I felt like doing, and I can violate them all I want. And then another influence was the gold leaf partition screens, and in like the Japanese samurai castles, they're enamored the interior, like the sliding screen doors are enamored with artwork and gilded gold. And so those are some of my influences that had attracted me and you know, eventually started working with gold and gilding and making my own sort of walls of gilded gold.
Well, and Gene, in making your own too, I have just about 2 to 3 minutes here. So I do want to mention, of course, your exhibition, True Colors, that feature different pieces, and they address and question societal issues also in some of them. So we have that, but also as far as looking ahead for you, what are there any particular themes that you envision exploring outside of what you've already done?
I'm always striving for is like, what's the next thing. So thematically, I've and having to live through the pandemic in LA and in the United States, I had, you know, a lot of True Colors had come out, and that was why I used True Colors for the title of my show, just because I saw so much social ills come out during the pandemic, and what I saw in the media was like all unfiltered. I never would have dreamt or imagined the things that I heard, saw taking place during the pandemic. Anyways, I think humans have gotten closer to becoming sort of more mechanical and robotic. So I'm thematically wanting to play. I want to explore the sort of relationship that humans have spiritually versus AI, artificial intelligence. And I think a lot of people are exploring and sort of also creating using that theme. But
it's an interesting time.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. And I feel like when I was, still painting out in the streets, it felt like the spray can was like this sort of new form, a new tool. And now it's evolved. People can spray paint through their computer and virtually. It's so weird.
It's fascinating. But I think there's a different feel when you actually have your hands out there, right? And you're in this place and you're just engaged.
Yeah, engagement, pragmatism. I feel like, I don't know if it dates me, but I feel like if you take the tool out of an artist's hand, it's almost like taking a basketball out of a basketball player's hand.
I'm so with you on that. I think there's a certain beauty to that, that we all as humans bring in our creative spaces. So, Gene, we are out of time. There is so much I would love to continue to talk to you
about, because
there's just so much depth. to all your work. Where, before we go here, is there a website or a social media handle? Where can people find you?
People can find me at LALouvre.com. That's okay. The gallery that represents me out here in Venice. Also, I have an Instagram handle. It's gajinfujita.la, and people can find me there. I'm working towards another solo show happening in Berlin next year. In the fall. So that'll be early September. At the Bookman Gallery. And so those are the things that will be coming up. I don't mean to plug in the LA Library.
No, please do, because I wanted to mention that myself, because I think I have one as well. But you had created for the LA Public Library, which is a huge entity in Los Angeles.
This was the library card.
So beautiful.
Back in 2019, I think. And sorry, it's out because they were very limited. There was only 100,000 made. But people can find products or gift ideas. Since it's the holidays, I might as well plug in the library store in downtown. You can find t-shirts, postcards like this, tote bags with this image on it. And I think
they
make good gifts.
Yes, it's a great gift to have, and it's always a nice reminder of the incredible work you do. Well, Gajin Fujita, it is such a pleasure having you on our show, and I really, really enjoyed speaking to you. So thank you for joining me on today's show.
Oh, thank you, Rasha, and thank you for having me. Thank your producer, Kathleen.
Absolutely.
You guys are kind to have me on. Thank you.
Oh, well, we appreciate you being a pivotal voice in this community as well. And for all my viewers, our listeners, we'd love to hear from you as well. So if you have any ideas or suggestions or even questions you'd like to throw out, please do send them our way. And don't forget to subscribe to our program on your favorite podcast platform, as well as follow us on Facebook, Twitter, X, Instagram, and our YouTube channel, where you can find so many beautiful stories. Asian Pacific Voices Radio is produced by Asian Culture and Media Alliance, a nonprofit that empowers the Asian Pacific American communities with a voice through media arts. Now, if you'd like to support our program or find out more information about us, please do visit AsianPacificVoicesRadio.com. Once again, I'm Rasha Goel. Please do join us next week for another thought-provoking and exciting show on Asian Pacific Voices Radio. Until then, take care and have a fabulous week.